Several weeks ago, I went down to the Tivoli Theater on the Loop on the final night of the St. Louis International Film Festival because the movie they were showing that night was one I knew I wanted to see. It's called Darkest Hour. It is a movie about the beginning of Winston Churchill's reign as the Prime Minister of England, the first of two times he was chosen to lead England. This was in May of 1940, when the previous Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, had kind of backed the country into nearly negotiating with Hitler rather than standing up and saying, we're not going to surrender, we're not going to negotiate. It took Winston Churchill in a very famous radio address to explain to his countrymen and to the world that England had a new policy about how they were going to handle this.
When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat bottom boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British expeditionary force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation. The British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
That is Winston Churchill giving a radio address on the BBC in May of 1940, a full year and a half before the United States entered World War II. This movie, Darkest Hour, stars Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, and I'll get into a full review of that when we do our showbiz show today in the 4 o'clock hour. But when I went to the screening of the movie at SLIFF on its final night, before the movie we heard from Tim Riley, who's with me now. Tim is the chief curator of the National Winston Churchill Museum at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, about 100 minutes west of St. Louis. Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Thanks for having me on the show.
Were you stirred again by hearing those words you probably have heard many, many times?
Oh, you never get tired of hearing those words, especially over the radio. I think it's great to have them broadcast on the radio.
Absolutely. Why is the National Churchill Museum at Westminster College?
Well, you know, the Darkest Hour in the film you were talking about talks about Churchill's first few weeks as Prime Minister. The reason the Churchill Museum is in Fulton is really the last part of Churchill's premiership. You know, after the war, there was a general election in Great Britain, and Churchill's party lost the election. He was arguably the most recognizable figure in the world, but he was out of a job. And he received invitations from all over the world to come and speak. And he received a one-page typewritten letter from the president of Westminster College, Frank McClure, inviting him to come and give an address at Westminster College. And I'm convinced that Churchill would have politely given it to his secretary and said, tell them I can't possibly come, save for a handwritten note in longhand in the bottom of the letter, in the margin. It said, this is a wonderful school in my home state. Hope you can do it. I'll introduce you, Harry Truman.
Mm.
And because Harry Truman invited Churchill to Fulton, Churchill knew he was going to be back in the game. He was somewhat despondent after he lost the election, and here was a chance for him to make an important speech next to the President of the United States, and that's where Churchill gave his famous post-war Iron Curtain speech for the famous phrase, an Iron Curtain has descended across the continent. So, you know, the history happened in Fulton because of Churchill and Truman, and the museum was constructed 15 years after the speech, and today we are the nation's Churchill Museum.
Explain to me why, after winning World War II and rallying his country from really the depths of despair in 1940 to victory, thanks to the United States and the other allies getting involved, but why was he voted out of office?
You know, I think particularly for Americans, you know, we are astonished by that fact. But, you know, the fact is Churchill was an extremely accomplished wartime leader, and he did mobilize his forces and rally his people, especially in the beginning of the World War II. You know, by the end of the war, he did not campaign well, people were looking for peace, and they wanted a leadership that focused on domestic issues and things that Churchill just, quite frankly, didn't have time to do during the war. And so they loved Winston the man, but they didn't think he was the right man for the right job right after the war. So he lost the election.
I mentioned that speech in May of 1940 was a full year and a half before the U.S. got into the war. But that was not without entreaties from Churchill to FDR, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Churchill and FDR had a correspondence that predated America's involvement after Pearl Harbor, and Churchill was imploring the United States for help, for aid, for warships, destroyers, the Lend-Lease program, and Churchill was wooing FDR. There's no question about it, trying to do everything he could to have the United States help Britain in their darkest hour.
Why didn't we?
Well, I think for FDR, he had some elections to win, and he was also facing a nation that had still remembered World War I, sending millions of troops to Europe, and there was a national sentiment that we didn't want to do that again. So it took some time for Roosevelt to convince the people, and of course after Pearl Harbor, there was no question that the United States would enter the war.
Speaking of World War I, Winston Churchill first became a member of Parliament not in 1940, but 40 years earlier. He was elected to Parliament for the first time and then left government to be involved in World War I himself, right?
Yes, I mean, Churchill had a meteoric rise as a young parliamentarian, became the first Lord of the Admiralty. He was in charge of the British Navy during World War I. Unfortunately, after the disaster in the Dardanelles, the Battle of Gallipoli, where there were massive casualties on the British side, Churchill was forced to resign his position as first Lord of the Admiralty. He voluntarily went to the trenches in Belgium. The former First Lord of the Admiralty became Lieutenant Colonel Churchill. Very few leaders would do that today.
In the years before he became Prime Minister, had he been warning of the Nazi threat?
Yes. Churchill throughout the 1930s. He was a member of parliament, but without ministerial office. He himself called the decade leading up to 1939, his years in the political wilderness. But he knew, he saw full well what Hitler was up to and the rise of the Nazi Party, and would warn at every occasion he could, speeches in parliament, radio broadcasts to America. He was almost a lone voice in the wilderness saying, we must arm. But Neville Chamberlain and others preferred a policy of appeasement, because Britain, too, had severe memories of World War I and was not anxious to go back into a European conflict. But Churchill saw it all coming. And warned, and he was prescient.
That must have driven him crazy.
I think it did, but he was persistent. That's one of the great Churchillian traits of his leadership. He was a man of principle, and he was persistent, and in this case, he was right.
When I say it was driving him crazy, of course, we're talking about the British 1940s kind of crazy, where you're upset about things, but you can't go crazy about it publicly, right?
Well, Churchill did, he did go public with his warning.
Oh, he did.
Yes, he was very very critical of Chamberlain and others. When leading up to the war, so he did. But Churchill relaxed a lot in the 1930s. He wrote a lot of articles, books, painted. He found ways to keep himself occupied. That's for sure.
We talked about his relationship with FDR. The other part of the power triumvirate in the world at that time was the USSR, which was led by Joseph Stalin. Did Churchill get along with him?
He had to. He was forced to during the war, when the Soviet Union became Britain and the United States, an ally.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle Joe, as he was fondly called. But Churchill really did not like Stalin's policy. He loathed communism. It was a relationship. The big three, FDR, Stalin, and Churchill, had to wage war against the Germans. Churchill was not a fan of the policies of him, but it was a forced alliance, and it was needed, of course, during the war.
I know somebody else he wasn't a fan of, and that would be Mahatma Gandhi.
Yeah, he
this is a real black mark on the Churchill legacy, in my estimation.
Yes, I think he may have had the wrong idea about Gandhi and his. He saw him as a little bit of a rebel and a threat. Churchill loved India, but he loved India as a part of the British Empire.
Yeah,
and he
was opposed to the Indian independence movement, and he wanted Gandhi crushed, didn't he?
Yeah, he was very critical of Gandhi at times, and that's true.
I've got to ask you about a scene in the movie. Towards the end, I'm not giving anything away here, but towards the end, Churchill goes for a ride on the tube, the London subway system, and asks Britons what they think he should do about Hitler. That never happened, right?
No, not that was Churchill was said to have ridden the tube once much earlier in his career, and the joke is that he got on the Circle Line and didn't know when to get off. During the war he did not ride the public
train. There's no way the Prime Minister gets away from whatever kind of security they had in 1940 and just walks down into the subway station and gets on board and just, in the movie it's a cute scene, but there's no way that could have happened, right?
No, that would not have happened in during the war.
Okay. Let's talk about after he left office in 1946. He goes off, he does other things, and then how does he get back into the Prime Minister's office to lead the country again in the 50s, and by the way, during another war, the Korean War.
Right. Well, he was the leader of the opposition party, and the way the parliamentary system works is it's you vote for the party, and the leader of the party becomes usually Prime Minister. And he was the leader of the opposition party, and the Conservative Party won the election in 1951, so Churchill was back in the top spot as Prime Minister for the second time from 51 to 55. And you're absolutely right, he was dealing with Korea, he was dealing with the Cold War, The Iron Curtain that he warned about in Fulton had, you know, almost become a is becoming a reality, and Churchill's faced with that. And you know, he longed to bring people to the negotiating table. You know, Churchill made popular the term summit meeting, and desperately wanted to have a meeting with the Americans and the Soviets so they could talk through some of these issues. But unfortunately, it didn't happen. And then when his old friend Eisenhower became president in 1953, you know, Churchill, you know, didn't have the kind of relationship he had with former presidents. And of course, the post-war economy in Britain, you know, England was broke, and America had been, you know, displaced at Britain as the world power. So, you know, his second premiership was very different than the first.
In addition to the global crises, England was still rebuilding then in the 50s, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, so much of it had been bombed by the Nazis that they, in a lot of places, their neighborhoods were bricks and mortar on the ground, not in buildings.
Absolutely. Into the 50s and into the 60s, you know, at the National Churchill Museum in Fulton. You know, the largest work in our collection is a Christopher Wren church that was bombed on December 29th, 1940, by the Luftwaffe.
Wait a second. You have a church that was in London?
Yes. It was a Christopher Wren church on the eve of December 29th, 1940, the Luftwaffe launched an air raid over London, dropped incendiary bombs in the city, and one of the great Christopher Wren parish churches took a direct hit, gutted the interior, and it was left in ruins, just the shell of the building, until the 1960s, because the British couldn't afford to rebuild it, and they couldn't really afford to tear it down. And that's when Westminster College decided to commemorate Churchill's Iron Curtain speech by bringing over, stone by stone, from central London, Christopher Wren Church, and rebuilt it in Fulton. It's a great testament to resilience, you know, getting knocked down and getting back up again like Churchill did. Churchill himself was 88 years old when he learned about the project, endorsed it, and was quite proud that this was going to be happening.
Never returned to Fulton, though, in that church again, right?
No, he didn't.
Yeah.
Family members have visited since, but Churchill never made a return trip to
Fulton. I'm fascinated by the notion of taking the bricks of an old church, loading them up onto pallets, putting those pallets on board, I'm sure, boats. They weren't flown here, so they probably had to come across the ocean and then come across half of America and then rebuilt. Did Christopher Wren leave his blueprints? How do you do that?
Well, they numbered every stone as they took them down, and it was referred to by the British press at the time the largest jigsaw puzzle in the history of architecture. But it's something you don't do every day, that's for sure. And a bold move by Westminster College. I mean, it was bold to invite Churchill there in the first place, and another bold move to bring this church over. So there's a history there of swinging for the fences, if you will.
All right, last thing I've got to ask you, Tim, because I've been talking into radio microphones since I was in high school. That's a long, long time ago. I'm curious, we played a piece of his radio speech there, the famous "We'll fight them on the beaches, etc." speech. How important was radio to the Winston Churchill legacy?
Very important. In fact, that speech, I should just note though, that was a speech he made in Parliament. So that was not originally broadcast.
Oh.
In fact, the clip you played was recorded after the war, much later, by Churchill. So that was a recording. He went back and dusted off his speeches.
I apologize for giving people the impression that was real from the original speech.
But Churchill did, love the radio and used it to his advantage. As Edward R. Murrow said, you know, Churchill mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. I think that's a true sentiment. Churchill understood the power of radio broadcasts, and it really did. Those speeches really did rally a nation when they needed it the most.
And literally mobilized people onto the water to go save the guys at Dunkirk.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. It's a terrific story, one that most Americans don't know. I mentioned before I talked to you that in the United States, we know the story of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and some of our other presidents. But our knowledge of world history is really the world between our own borders. But I'm sure in England, the Winston Churchill story is as familiar to them as those guys are to us.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, he's still seen as the greatest Briton, even today. And I think this new film and the other popular images in the Netflix Crown series, for instance, Churchill mm-hmm. is in season one, I think will reintroduce or introduce for the first time Churchill to new audiences. And that excites me as a museum. That's our mission and purpose. We want to make sure that Churchill's legacy and lessons of leadership and resilience, these are universal qualities that Churchill exhibited in spades, and I think these are qualities that are worth looking at.
The movie is called The Darkest Hour. It's opening today in St. Louis. The National Winston Churchill Museum at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, about 100 minutes west of St. Louis, is open all the time for you to go visit. Tim Riley is the chief curator there. Thanks so much for joining me here today to share some of this history with us.
Well, thank you, Paul, and we'll see you in Fulton soon.
All right, I hope to get out there.
Okay.
This is the Big 550 KTRS.